From WBUR Boston, I'm Mike Pesca in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If this is a dream no one's woken up quite yet, the Knicks beat the defending champion Dallas Mavericks last night, with New York's Jeremy Lin contributing 28 points and 14 assists. The Harvard-educated Taiwanese-American humble Christian point guard, whose phenomenal play seemed to come from nowhere, has sparked a conversation about ethnicity, sports, stereotypes, and talent. Oh yeah, and teardrop jumpers and no-look passes. This hour, On Point, Jeremy Lin. How's he doing it, and how do we miss him? ESPN is reveling in it all.
Linsanity.
It's Linsanity.
This is a great story.
I love this story.
It's an underdog story. Who doesn't like an underdog story?
This kid is ready for this moment.
He's a winner.
Came from nothing to greatness.
We have a true point guard in Jeremy Lin.
Jeremy Lin is everything New York.
He's got that swagger.
He has shined and evolved into the best story in sports today.
You can be part of that story. Join the conversation. Have you caught Linsanity? How did Lin slip through the cracks? You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from San Francisco, California, is Phil Taylor, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. He's been following Jeremy Lin since Lin's high school days. Hello, Phil.
Hi, Mike.
So there you are in the Bay Area. Kid at Palo Alto High School is doing some amazing things, and you go watch him in high school?
I did, yeah. Actually, it wasn't even because he was doing amazing things. I just happened to live very near Palo Alto High School where Jeremy played, and occasionally, just out of boredom, and because I love basketball and sports in general, I would stop by Pally, as it's known locally, just to watch a high school game. And I remember seeing him two or three times, I guess his junior year, and every time he was the guy who caught my eye. I mean, I wasn't really looking for him, but your eye is just drawn to the most dynamic player, and that was definitely Jeremy Lin. So I really, I guess, you know, when you talk about all the people who missed on him, I was one of them too, because I was impressed from those days and followed him from then on with some degree of closeness. And he excelled everywhere he went, as I followed him at Harvard and throughout his college career. And I still never really thought about him as a potential NBA player. So I missed just as much as the Warriors and Rockets and every other NBA scout.
So there he is. He leads the Palo Alto Vikings past Mater Dei, a powerhouse, wins the high school championship there in the state of California, goes to Harvard. He's a great player for Harvard, drops 30 on UConn. So if some of our listeners don't know, UConn's a really good team and Harvard's not. So it would seem that he's doing these amazing things. But when he entered the NBA, what did you think his ceiling was?
I thought maybe he could be a solid backup point guard for someone. You know, he seemed like the sort of guard who was good at penetrating, good at distributing the ball. I thought probably he would be a little bit weak on defense, because I thought maybe he didn't have quite the same lateral quickness that a lot of NBA guards have. I guess at best that's what I thought, that he might be able to make a roster and eventually get into a rotation where he would be the second guard off the bench. So I never saw anything like this.
And let's go back 2 years. If we knew then what we know now, and it was the 2010 draft where John Wall went first and Evan Turner went second, where do you think Jeremy Lin would go?
That's a good question. I mean, I think Wall would probably still go ahead of him, because Wall has been a good player.
He has amazing speed and athleticism. Not quite as refined a game as Jeremy Lin, but people love that raw talent. Okay, I'll give you that.
Exactly. I certainly think, you know, without the draft and the list in front of me, certainly I think he would go ahead of Evan Turner. I think, you know, he may be number two.
Maybe number two.
If you look at what he's done, if we...
The other guys on the list, by the way, yeah, the other guys are guys like Derek Favors and Patrick Patterson and Epke Udo. And so, yeah, you're right. I was thinking the same thing.
Oh, forget it. Yeah. He
maybe would be a top five draft pick. And so then the question is, when you were missing him, like all the GMs were missing on what they had, was the main problem a failure of imagination? Or do you have to control yourself and say, look, even if it looks good and even if he's doing that, let's remember he's not playing against top competition, and that becomes your mantra? I'm trying to locate the exact nature of all of our mistake when we whiffed on Lin.
I really think it was a failure of imagination. I mean, I don't think, you know, because we've seen players from small schools, schools that aren't known for their basketball prowess, make it to the NBA and make it in other professional sports. So that's the fact that he went to Harvard, I think, may have been a little bit of an obstacle for him to overcome. And that may have been part, a small factor in why he was so underestimated. But I think it was much more the fact that he's Asian American, and we had never seen an American-born Asian player play to this level in the NBA, and certainly not play point guard in the NBA. So I really do think that that a lot of people looked at him and saw that he was a fine player, but they just couldn't quite get over that mental hurdle of his being Asian American. Because when you look back at his career, at his statistics, at his accomplishments, he excelled at every level, and he has the resume of an NBA player. You know, even though he played against weaker competition, he dominated that competition. And when he got a chance to play against better competition like UConn, like Boston College, as you mentioned, he did extremely well. So there was every indication that this player could be a successful NBA point guard. But I think, his name was Jeremy Lin, and it wasn't Jeremy Smith.
Right.
I think that was the problem.
And there wasn't one empirical statistic attached to him, like three-point shooting or free throw shooting, that was off the chart. It was an eye test. Well, talking about this very issue, and joining me from Los Angeles, California, is Jay Caspian King, editor at Grantland, which is an ESPN website, contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. His forthcoming book is The Dead Do Not Improve, a novel. Hey, Jay.
Hey, how's it going, Mike?
Good. It's so Kang. I was. Sorry, say again.
It's Kang.
Kang.
Not King, but that's okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It happens a lot.
But you're gonna rule over a conversation when I bring up a web post that you made, I think, before you were writing for Grantland, probably before Grantland existed, where on the Asian American sports sites, and you noted there are such things, the talk was of Jeremy Lin. And what was the talk, and what did you bring to that conversation back then when he was dominating at Harvard?
I wrote that actually right after the UConn game when he dunked over, I think it was Jerome Dyson. And I think what I was talking about was that a lot of Asian sports fans had been aware of Jeremy Lin, but, you know, you don't really see many Harvard games. And once that video footage started coming out, I think it was a different level of excitement because we didn't really know what his game was like, but the fact that he was playing athletically and he was challenging people and he was being competitive, I think that sort of ran counter to a lot of stereotypes that traditionally are held about Asian American males. And I think that's sort of what got everyone really geeked at the very beginning.
Beyond the fact that we like it when someone who looks like us or someone who we assume has a similar background to us excels, what about specifically about the stereotypes was every time Lin got a step on the defender, a knife through the defense, what else was he knifing through?
Well, I do think that it was not like Yao, where Yao sort of played
Yao Ming, Houston Rockets.
Yeah,
Center.
Yao Ming,
yep.
Where it was just sort of, it could be attributed to a freak of nature, really. Like Yao was 7'5" and could shoot, and you know that can all be sort of explained away, just being like, well, somewhere in a billion people in China, someone is going to be 7'5". But having a kid who grew up in similar households, I think, to most, you know, that was identifiable to a lot of Asian American kids. I think that we'd never seen anything like that before. And the NBA is a lot different than baseball or even the NFL, where you can see the faces right up close. The players exhibit way more personality. It's way more racialized than any of those sports. And so to have a player in that realm, I think, was sort of explosive. And, you know, right now you see sort of the explosion everywhere. I think it's all that anyone ever talks about, at least within people I know, Asian Americans, non-Asian Americans. So, yeah, I think it's a really strange and explosive mix.
And do you agree with Phil Taylor that even if this were a kid from Harvard, if he were a black kid or if he were, you know, a white kid from Central Europe, we could process it more if he was getting the same step on his defender and finishing around the basket exactly like Lin finished? He'd be either drafted or given a better shot earlier than he had one?
I do agree with that, but You know, I also think that he didn't really light it up at Harvard. He played really well, and in those big games against Boston College and against UConn, like you guys are talking about, he rose to the occasion and really sort of played at a higher level. If you look at his stat lines at Harvard, it's not like he wasn't like Kurt Thomas where he was putting up 30 and 20.
Right. 16 and a half points a game, and since he started in the NBA, he's putting up well over 20. Yeah.
Sure, and I mean, I can't imagine that there's ever been an Ivy League player, or even any sort of mid-major player who's really played well in the NBA after putting up 16 points a game, especially as his team's primary scorer. So, I mean, if you, any sort of statistical measure for Jeremy Lin, I don't think that, you know, I think he was probably drafted. The fact that he went undrafted isn't really all that surprising. And even if it only lasts a moment, Jeremy Lin took it and owned it. You gotta respect him. Undrafted, the talk of the league, from afterthought to all over TV. I tell you, hard work is the key, but this is what can happen when you dream. I'm Jeremy Lin.
This is On Point. I'm Mike Pesca, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the NBA's new star, Jeremy Lin. He lit it up yesterday afternoon against the Mavericks.
Jeremy Lin, his fifth steal of this game.
And he headmans Duke Chandler for the exclamation point. The show continues on Broadway.
Spotlight shining on Jeremy Lin, and you can join the conversation. Did you catch his games in the past week? What do you make of Lin's playing? Whether you're a stock picker or a cattle judge, how do you find undervalued assets? We're with Phil Taylor, senior writer at Sports Illustrated, and with Jay Caspian Kang, editor at Grantland, which is owned by ESPN. He also writes for the New York Times Magazine. One Facebook comment says, in part, and I want to throw this to you, Jay, Lin is, my wife is from mainland China. I speak Mandarin. My children will be both American and Chinese. Lin is one of the few American men of Asian ancestry to be celebrated and accepted by the overall American populace. He's caught on for his exceptional story and unique background. And then the commenter, Lucas Blaustein, goes on to say, the next step is we can simply start admiring Lin for playing the sport and leave his religion and ethnicity out of the conversation. Jay, I've enjoyed the talk about ethnicity. There has been a couple of ugly racist comments, but so far it seems to be an interesting conversation, and not all racial conversations are racist. But what's your take?
I don't think there's any need to push this into the colorblind sort of race consensus where we all say, hey, let's not talk about his race at all. I mean, I think that his anomaly and sort of the way that he carries himself, and also just the NBA as a ground for talking about race, I think all that stuff is pretty productive and interesting. And I think that it would be a shame, because I think that, you know, sports is basically America's only real meritocracy. I think that's, you know, arguable. It's maybe the closest thing that we have. And, you know, I think that in that way, it becomes really interesting to sort of prod discussions about race and, you know, and achievement, accomplishment, why people are overlooked. And I just feel like, even just for Asian Americans who are so happy about it, I mean, why deprive them the chance of talking about race in the first real sort of very public, very positive way that's happened in a while.
Yes, don't deprive Filipinos their Pacquiao, don't deprive Italians their DiMaggio, and don't deprive Asians their Jeremy Lin. Phil Taylor. So we talked about sports perhaps being a meritocracy, at least as it comes with race, but it's not a meritocracy as far as pedigree. Is there any impetus? Do you think the Lin story will prompt GMs or the people who evaluate talent to do a serious reconsideration of their methods, or will they say, hey, every once in a while one slips through?
Well, I think it'll probably generate, it will make talent evaluators a little bit more open-minded, I would imagine. Just as when Dirk Nowitzki became a star coming from Germany, I think that made talent evaluators start to look for the next Dirk and maybe take European players more seriously. I think the same thing will happen here. I certainly think the next, for instance, Asian American player, wherever he may come from, wherever he may play collegiately, will probably be taken maybe a little bit more seriously because of Jeremy Lin. So I do think it may not be a kind of a systemic official decision to make that to judge people more differently. But I think generally speaking, the fact that so many people missed on Jeremy Lin will change the way that NBA people look at all players in the future.
That seems too narrow to me. I mean, it's for the good, but, you know, okay, so the next time a Taiwanese-American point guard lights it up at Harvard, we will take note. That's not that should not be the lesson. I think that there is a decent case, just like to analogize to another sport. The lesson of Moneyball, Michael Lewis's book about the Oakland A's in baseball, wasn't that we should draft guys who have a high on-base percentage. That was the narrow lesson of Moneyball. The real lesson was we should start thinking about who is a good player in radically different ways. And I don't know, Phil, if you know if the NBA is near where baseball is in terms of advanced metrics or being willing to rethink their thinking, but why shouldn't it be? You know, I mean, this should be if the Knicks go far in the playoffs, this should prompt a sea change, I think.
Well, the NBA has made some inroads in terms of advanced metrics. Some teams more than others. The Houston Rockets with their GM Daryl Morey are probably the best known Moneyball-like team in the NBA.
Daryl Morey has an advanced degree from MIT, and he also was a guy who cut Jeremy Lin.
That's very true. So it's apparently his system isn't foolproof.
Right. And he doesn't have a bias towards Cambridge based players. But go ahead.
True. But I'm not sure if advanced metrics and different sets of analytics would have identified Jeremy Lin. As Jay said earlier, his more traditional stats weren't fantastic at Harvard. And I'm not sure if crunching the numbers differently would have identified Jeremy Lin or will identify other players. I think in some sense it is more of an eye test, and it is more of a need to be more open to the fact that good players can come from everywhere. Because I'm not sure that the numbers would have changed Jeremy Lin's story.
Well, joining us right now is a key player in the Jeremy Lin saga, drama, and triumph. Doc Shepler is a coach in the San Francisco region, Los Angeles, Los Altos, California, actually. And Doc, welcome to On Point. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing today? It's great listening to your conversation.
We're doing well. How did you come to give Lin some pointers in coaching, as I understand it, during the off season?
Well, his high school coach is a gentleman that I coached in high school way back when. I coached in the Bay Area for 35 years, and Peter Diepenbrock was his high school coach, and I was Peter's high school coach, and I coached Peter at Burlingame High School, where I coached for 17 years, and I have been coaching at Pinewood School in Los Altos Hills girls basketball for 17 years. And in that time, Peter watched my teams play, I watched his teams play, we give each other feedback. He wanted me to come watch this freshman boy play basketball about 8 or 9 years ago named Jeremy Lin. And I was immediately impressed right away with his ability to see the game. I mean, his ability to do those things at such a young age was extraordinary. And that's one of the things that has amazed me about him, is that you just don't do that at 14 years old. You don't see the game. You don't make decisions. You don't deliver the ball at the proper angles at that young of age without a special gift. And that was one of his things that makes him special. Peter wanted me to work with him on a shot when he was first signed by the Warriors, but he got a better offer to go with Yao Ming on a Chinese tour. So I never really got a chance to work with him on cleaning up the shot. That's probably one of the weakest parts of his game in high school and in college, where he didn't have a repeatable shot that would be consistent enough. So he definitely had to make the changes.
And why this works, to explain, even if you're lightning quick and he's very fast, and even if you could get inside defenses and then decide whether to shoot or whether to pass, if you don't have a shot that defenses have to honor, they could play off you a little bit. It affects your ability to do everything else. So you have to have a shot to keep defenses honest. So he comes to you, and what is, if we look at the tape of his shooting motion at Harvard versus today, is his shooting motion much different thanks to you?
I would like to take a lot of credit for that, sure. No, it's definitely he's got a textbook shot right now. I mean, when we work for probably 6 to 7 months in the off season, two of those months he was injured with a partially torn patella tendon that occurred toward the end of this Warrior season, so he couldn't really do any jumping after his procedure. So we just worked on a perfect release, and after the to work on a perfect release. I had been working with his younger brother, Joseph, for a month, and Jeremy would come over to the house, and I'd have Jeremy Lin and his brother in my backyard working on form shooting, and worked with his brother on different skill sets and things like that. And Jeremy knew right away that I could probably help him. And then when he was healthy, then we attacked it 3 to 4 times a week, basically establishing a foundation of perfect form and great footwork into it. And then we worked on different shooting situations. He's got so many shots in his bag of tricks.
Have we seen them all?
He hasn't used them all.
He's got some secret weapons.
I swear. he's still getting space in triple threat. Still gets space off a dribble. And matter of fact, I'm having lunch with him in about an hour, so I'm going to be talking about those things with him just a little bit to try and get him to have a mindset of a shooter. You know, a mindset of a shooter is I'm planning to shoot every time I get it. Although he's a point guard, I still want him to have an aggressive mindset, because the numbers he was putting up in the gym during drills were phenomenal. Phenomenal. He's the best shooter I've ever seen, and I was criticized by that by a radio talk show host in San Francisco named Bob Fitzgerald. I'm sure Phil knows him, and of course he knows it all. Not Phil, but Fitzgerald.
But who else have you seen? Better than Jason Kidd? He's a Bay Area all-star.
Jason Kidd's a terrible shooter.
That's
Come
true.
On.
I just threw that out there as fodder.
No, but I've coached
better than Steph. Better than Stephen Curry, Golden State Warrior shooting great Steph Curry.
Well, I've never been in a gym with him.
Okay.
You know, in terms of preparing Jeremy for the Warrior season, that was a mindset we had: was you're going into training camp and you're going to kick Stephen Curry's butt, and you're going to kick Monte's butt, and you're going to be ready. And we worked on a variety of finishes. Floaters, runners, different things like that. And I think the difference in his game from last year to this year is now, you know, he's got shots in his bag that he can utilize. And plus, you add that to his vision. And the main thing is just that: how can you go these last 2 weeks? It takes a special human being to play at the right anxiety level to play, you know, in this type of environment and be the guy and just come through time after time. Having not had the experience to do that takes a special individual, and that's the thing you just can't measure. So when you're talking draft choices and who's got what and who's got it, you just can't measure that in a human being. You have to let them experience. And Jeremy had just a really tough 2 months between December and February because he couldn't battle for a job. I mean, that's what the preparation in the off season was for: to get stronger, to get more explosive, to make his moves crisper and polished, and to clean up his shot. We did all that. So the frustration of not being even given a chance with the Warriors, going to Houston, have 3 guaranteed point guard contracts. They tried to get rid of those guys, but they couldn't. So they had to get rid of the non-guaranteed. They liked them.
Right.
And the Knicks picked them up, and, you know, here, you don't even go through a training camp with these guys, and you're just wallowing on the bench playing in Scribini time. And then all of a sudden, it's like before they were going to cut you, okay, we might as well give him a shot. Let's see what he can do. Bingo! Look out, America. Welcome to the Jeremy Lin Show.
So he's coachable. He's mentally tough. He's got the physical attributes able to put your coaching into action. What are the weaknesses of his game?
Great learner.
Doc, what do you think the weakness?
You know, I think there are some skillful things he's weak at. I don't want to get too technical, but he's got to get a tighter handle on the ball. He's got to make a quicker decision when he gets in the paint. Sometimes I think he gets, you know, a little bit too far and the angles close down on him. I think he's got to shoot more. I think he's got to, you know, if people know he's a deadly shooter as well as that, they're going to give him less space, and that might open up a cleaner driving angle for him. Defensively, I think his on-ball defense has got to get better. And, of course, with Amari, you know, helping out on screens, it doesn't do him any good. I mean, you know, when Calderon torched the Knicks the other night, it was, you know, Jeremy got, you know, criticized for him. See, his defense isn't good. Well, you know, when nobody's stepping up and showing on a ball screen and giving him any help, Amari, it doesn't really help him out any. You know, Amari's not known for defensive intensity and principles and things like
that's
that.
That's true, so. But let me tell you, Doc, you're making New York Post and Daily News headlines, which is Lin's old coach calls out Amari's defense. Stay with us 1 second. Phil Taylor, Jay Caspian-King, you guys are journalists. You have a question you want to ask Doc Shepler?
Yeah, actually, you know, I was more interested in the technical aspects of it. I mean, how do you think that he needs to shoot a lot more from the outside? Because it's hard to imagine that he goes in the lane so much and into traffic so much, and that's where a lot of the turnovers happen. And it does seem like he has that step back. I mean, I don't. Yeah. Can he do that from like 18?
What's his range, Doc?
No question. We worked every shooting situation. He's got him in his bag. And I'm worried about him getting hurt because when he gets into the decision zone, when he gets by and he gets lane, I'm worried about him. He's got to incorporate his floater in the mix, and that's a 2-foot Tony Parker floater. I mean, we worked a lot on that in the offseason. He hasn't really showed that a lot. He had a couple 1-foot runners, but, you know, when you're driving to the paint and you're going full speed, I think he's going a little bit out of control to where he can't react to what the defense is doing because he's still accelerating when he gets in there. And a lot of 1-foot finishes going off 1 foot to where he's flying in there trying to draw fouls, and sometimes he doesn't get them because it just looks like he's trying to draw a foul. But he's got all the shots. He's got a great pullback. He's got a great pull-up. He can hit a triple threat shot. He's got a great jab and shoot. All those things we worked on from NBA 3, and he can hit those shots 65-70% in drills.
All right.
In drills.
Doc, I want to thank you for spending some time with us. Thank you, Doc.
Sorry I talked your ear off.
You know what? You're passionate. I loved it. And how'd you guys like that? A girls high school coach from Los Altos, California, calling out Phil, calling out Amari Stoudemire on defense. Pretty good stuff, right?
That was very interesting. And it, you know, just to add to Doc's credibility, he's a girls high school coach, and his high school team at Pinewood, his program is a real dynasty. And anyone in the Bay Area or in California knows that he knows what he's talking about. He's kind of maybe the John Wooden of Bay Area girls basketball.
Or the Pat Summit of high school or something.
Or yeah, perhaps that's a better analogy.
The male,
but he's absolutely right. And you're right. It'll be interesting. I wonder if you were having, I think, Frank Asola from the Daily News on later, and I wonder if he'll give Doc Shepler a call and get some good Amari bashing quotes for the tabloids.
Oh, that's not like what the tabloids, what their methods are, right? Goosing the guy who's going to go off and make a back page headline. And that's just another thing I like about Lin and the Palo Alto story. You got the Taiwanese American kid, you got the girls high school coach, and I noticed everything you need to know about Palo Alto High School. The story about Lin winning the high school championship was written by, I think, Clarissa Schwartz and Siddhartha Oza. So it's a melting pot over there. This is On Point. I'm Mike Pesca in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Jeremy Lin, the NBA's new star. How does Lin himself explain what's been going on?
I think it's a miracle from God is the way I would describe it, just because obviously I don't think anybody expected this to happen the way it happened.
Humility is his fort. We're talking with Phil Taylor, senior writer at Sports Illustrated, and with Jay Caspian Kang, editor at Grantland, contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Let's take a call. Ben is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hello, Ben. You're on the air.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. Go right ahead.
So, Mike, I clearly Jeremy Lin is doing really well, but you seem pretty much ready to put him in the Hall of Fame. Earlier, we were talking about
the Taiwanese American basketball player Hall of Fame. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Earlier, we were talking about, you know, what happens if he leads the Knicks deep into the playoffs. I think we got to look at sample size here. I'm not saying that he's not good, but you're so excited that you seem. I mean, we got to remember that this is less than 10 games.
Right.
And in addition, you know, you've been asking how could he slip through. Well, we just kind of seems to have heard it. He didn't really have much of a shot, apparently, before this offseason. So that explains a lot of how he slipped through. So I think we just want to keep those things in mind.
Ben, you're right. Any statistician will tell you that sample size is often a cruel mistress. Look at Tim Tebow. He won a bunch of games, but really, is that a strong enough sample size? But Phil, you know, basketball is different from baseball. You don't get 600 at-bats. And can you really play this well in nine games and just regress to the mean? Or do these nine games pretty much prove that you have the ability to be an NBA starter, even above average starter?
Well, I don't know what a mathematician would say, but I do think that although this is a small sample size, I think if you actually examine the sample, it does indicate that this isn't a fluke. And you're right, this isn't like baseball where a guy comes up from the minor leagues and gets a bunch of fastballs and hits five home runs in the first week, and then they figure out that he can't hit a slider and everything changes for him. You know, what Jeremy Lin has done, kind of the keys to his success have been things that I don't think are going to go away, that they're very repeatable, and they're attributes. You know, his vision, his ability to penetrate, you know, those sorts of things, his anticipation, those sorts of things are permanent. And especially when you look at the fact that within this small sample size, teams have thrown all sorts of different kinds of defenses at him. You know, they started off when he his first couple of games against the Nets and against Utah, they really didn't know what they underestimated him. They played him one-on-one. They didn't force him any one particular way at first. And then they figured out some things. They figured out he doesn't go as well to his left, so they tried to force him that way. They sent double teams at him. I mean, if you look at the difference between the way the Nets played him in his first game and the way the Dallas Mavericks played him on Sunday, it's like night and day. The Mavericks were totally focused on stopping Jeremy Lin, and they still couldn't do it. So it may be too soon to put him in the Hall of Fame, but you do have to take a look at what he's done so far and realize that he's already passed a lot of tests with flying colors.
Yep. Joining me now is Frank Izzola. He is the beat writer, covers the Knicks for the New York Daily News. Hello, Frank.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for coming on. So it seems crazy and cluttered and a little magical to us on the outside. What are we outsiders missing about this last week or 10-plus days of Jeremy Lin?
Well, it has been complete madness. You know, you really have never seen a story like this. And it's just interesting that it happened to a Knicks franchise that has not won a playoff game in 10 years. They finally had their first winning season in 10 years last year. And, you know, the Knicks way and the Knicks model has always been to throw lots and lots of money at big-name players. And even if the parts don't really fit, they still throw money at these guys. And then they have a player like Jeremy Lin kind of fall into their lap that's, you know, making under $1 million, which for the NBA isn't really a lot of money. And he really is the fifth-string point guard of the team. And the only reason he got a chance to play is because Baron Davis, another big-name player that the Knicks brought in, had so many setbacks that they finally said, the heck with it. Let's give this guy a chance and see what he can do. And ever since that game, I guess it's now been, 15, 16 days ago against the New Jersey Nets, and he hasn't come out of the lineup since then.
Yeah, and it is incredible. The Knicks didn't really have any extra insight that anyone else had, and they lucked into this. In fact, a couple days before that breakout, he played some minutes against Houston, and he looked good, and then the next day, they didn't play him again.
Yeah, and it's funny you bring up that game against Houston because, you know, the night before, they had lost to Miami. Carmelo Anthony had pulled himself out of the lineup before the game. And the team was, you know, they seemed to be imploding a little bit. And then the following night against Houston, they got destroyed. He put Jeremy Lin in the game, I think it was with about 5 to 7 minutes to go in the third quarter. And it kind of looked like, you know, basically that was the human white flag by putting Jeremy Lin in the game at that time. But afterwards, Tyson Chandler, you know, who basically was, you know, he was pretty depressed on the state of affairs.
The Knicks center, free agent, probably the best player up until Lin this year, yep.
Exactly. And the one thing he said at that point, he sat in the locker room, he said, well, you know, the one good thing is I thought Jeremy, when he went in there, really showed some things. He got to the basket. I really think maybe he could be a guy that could help us. So Tyson Chandler was really the first guy. You know, maybe having played with Jason Kidd in Dallas, Chris Paul in New Orleans last year, you know, J.J. Barea did a very good job for Dallas. Maybe Tyson Chandler could see something that a lot of other people couldn't see. But that way, it was just odd that he had said that at the time. That always stuck out. in my mind that he said, oh, you know what, maybe this is a guy that could help us.
Yeah, and since then he's been the recipient of so many alley-oops, and Tyson Chandler right now is shooting over 70%, and a lot of it is credited to Jeremy Lin. You know, in basketball and sports, if a team wins seven straight, they're going to love their new teammate who sparked the winning streak. If they win eight of nine, they'll give him credit. And that's just natural, but is there something extra with Lin? What has his effect on the team been?
Oh, you definitely could see it. There's, you know, the comparison I would draw would be to, you know, Stephon Marbury, who clearly was a tremendously talented player, but his attitude, he was always pretty much a miserable guy, and I think that attitude, you know, when you're kind of a leader on the team, the guy in charge of the offense, you have the ball in your hands, and you have that kind of attitude, I think it trickles down to the team. As opposed to Jeremy Lin, he just brings all this optimism, all this joy to the game, and I think it's really rubbed off on his teammates. And I really noticed it when they were in Washington. They didn't have Stoudemire. Amari Stoudemire. He was home in Florida following the death of his brother. Carmelo Anthony didn't even make the trip. He was hurt. Baron Davis wasn't there. And you could just sense that the players were really enjoying themselves. And it's funny, you know, and Phil could speak to this as well. You know, you'd be surprised at how many guys don't like playing basketball that are in the NBA. And it's great to see a guy out there enjoying himself and actually having fun. And I thought, you know, that was really the one thing that stuck out.
How's he, as a quote, is he guarded? Is he forthcoming? Have you not been able to crack it yet?
I think he's a very private person. I think he's handled everything really well. You know, because there's been a huge demand on his time. Everyone wants to talk to him. And I think what you notice about Jeremy Lin is that he's always talking about the coaching staff and his teammates. It's never about him. So even in interviews, he's a great point guard. He's handing out the accolades to everyone else except himself. You know, I think, you know, he did mention at the press conference yesterday that he was asking the media in Taiwan to leave his family that is back in Taiwan alone, that they've been hounding them. And I think that part of it, I think, you know, he's getting tired of people asking him about his living arrangements. That part annoys him a bit.
Because it was famously reported he was living on his brother and then his teammate's couch. And so that's unusual. But I guess after 2,000 follow-up questions, it gets tiresome. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think he's just a private guy. He just, you know, would rather just talk about basketball. For the most part, he's a boring quote. He's not going to be like Charles Barkley and give you, you know, he's not going to say outrageous things. But I've just been impressed with the way he's handled it. But, you know, he comes from a good background. Obviously, his parents did a pretty good job because the kid did go to Harvard.
Yeah, the kid went to Harvard. In fact, the reason he even signed up for Palo Alto and not the school his brother went to is that they had a better science curriculum and he wanted to be a doctor. But the last question for you, Frank, is, you know, here we're talking about Jeremy Lin. Here's a guy who resurrects the Knicks season. He fills the arena. Everyone thought that was impossible. But what's really impossible is that he worked out a deal between, essentially, his presence made the cable provider and the MSG network come together on a deal. And why this is important is not a lot of people might realize Knicks fans couldn't even watch the Knicks in New York because the games weren't on Time Warner Cable. Are we giving him too much credit? Is he really responsible, or his presence really one of the reasons Knicks fans can now watch Knicks games?
Oh, I think he's directly responsible for that. And I don't think the people that had Time Warner were complaining early in the year that they couldn't watch the Knicks play because the Knicks were absolutely abysmal. But, you know, this guy became such a big story.
Right. Those of us with Verizon were complaining that we could watch the Knicks play. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, the thing, too, with a guy like Jeremy Lin, it's that, you know, obviously it's a great story, but look at the timing of it. It was after the Giants had won the Super Bowl. And really from the Super Bowl up until the start of spring training, it's really a dead period for sports in this country, except for college basketball, but then even then, like, college basketball is not that big. And I think he really filled a void. And I think he was on the back page of the papers for almost 7 or 8 days, which might be a record. I really can't remember any one player getting the back page and the front page on that many consecutive days.
Yeah, maybe Plexico Burris when he shot himself in the leg, something like that. Frank Izzola, sports writer for the New York Daily News, joins us from New York. Thanks so much, Frank.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And let's go to the calls now. Joe is calling us from Nashville, Tennessee. Joe, go right ahead.
Hey, Mike.
Hi.
Just curious. It's certainly a phenom that this gentleman, from his ethnicity, becomes tremendously successful in the NBA. But you got to also look at the guy, 6'2", 200 pounds, tremendous athlete. And as the coach from Palo Alto, the girls' coach, mentioned, athletics since the beginning, you can't measure a player's heart. And I think there should be some focus on what a tremendous athlete. The guy spent thousands of hours in the gym to get to this level. And I would compare him to a B.J. Armstrong-type player in terms of his skill level. And it's really about how can he distribute the ball and make the Knicks a better team, not about what's in his arsenal to score. But a great story, great player, and I think there should be some focus on his given talent way beyond his authenticity. How many Asian Americans do you meet, 6'2", 200 pounds, who can play with the greatest athletes in the world? Thank you.
Right. Thanks for the call, Joe. Phil Taylor, about his physical stature, and I think he's actually listed as 6'3". Is he athletic? Part of the narrative of the underdog is he didn't have all the physical tools, but he makes do with what he can. Well, does Jeremy Lin have the physical tools from an athletic standpoint?
You know, I really think he does. I think the assumption has been that he wasn't very physically talented. He's not the most athletic guy, and somehow he maximizes what little athletic ability he does have. And I think that does him a disservice. You know, when he first emerged and played a few good games, on my Twitter account, I heard from a lot of people, fans, who felt that he would come back to earth once NBA players really started overpowering him and backing him down in the low post and all these sorts of things. And, you know, you would have thought they were talking about that he was about Muggsy Bogues instead of instead of Jeremy Lin, that he was 5'3 instead of 6'3. I mean, he's 6'3, 200 pounds. You know, he's a perfectly good sized NBA point guard. When he the first time he dunked against the Washington Wizards, he beat John Wall, who is supposedly so much quicker than Lin. He beat him. Went right past him and went right to the rim and dunked the ball, and people went crazy. Even Tyson Chandler, his teammate, said, "I didn't know Jeremy could dunk." Well, again, you know, he's 6'3". He's in the NBA. Why should that be such a shock to people that Jeremy Lin can dunk? So I think you ignore what your eyes show you, and you you put these assumptions on him because of the stereotypes of Asian American men, I guess.
Yeah, but, and also,
I think he's a you know, he's not the greatest athlete as by NBA standards, but he's perfectly athletic.
And that it's also because we love the Rudy underdog narrative. They said it about Tim Tebow. People would say, here's a quarterback without the greatest skills in the world. Well, he can't throw the ball, but he has tremendous physical skills like size and speed. And Jay Kang, about that Tebow comparison, what do you make of it?
I think that it works on the faith-based part, but I think that Lin's game is a little more conventional than Tebow's, and I think that what he brings to the Knicks, I mean, from a basketball standpoint, I think is a lot different than what Tebow brought to the Broncos, where he was sort of inverting the traditional ways of playing football and running the ball, not throwing the ball, like completing less than 10 passes.
Right.
I mean, Lin is playing D'Antoni's system, and since Raymond Felton, who was point guard there last year, has left, they haven't had a point guard who can run Mike D'Antoni's system. And so I think in that way, it falls apart. I think in terms of the hype, Jeremy hasn't talked too much about his religion, but get a sense that that will start coming once he gets a little bit more comfortable with the media. I think in those ways, the comparison might be apt. But I mean, I every time I hear that, I sort of just think that that's sort of a big sports story and a big sports story, and there's not that much overlap there.
Yeah, it's a little lazy, and another big difference is that I think that even though it's the small sample size we talked about, Lin has proven that he has NBA skills, and I think the jury's still out on Tim Tebow. Let's try to sneak one more call here. John from Boston, what do you have to say about Jeremy Lin, John?
Hi, Mike. I've been enjoying your conversation, and I just wanted to bring up that you've been talking about how he's been, you know, how did he slip through under the radar?
Yeah.
And it seems to me that the intangibles that he offers, his enthusiasm, his ability to pass, to be a true point guard, those things often don't get recognized. Forget the fact that he's an Asian American.
Right. I understand what you're saying, and we're very tight on time. But, Phil, I want to ask you, we often fall into this trap. It's all the intangibles, and we talked about what a great athlete he is. But with Lin, do you give some credence to the intangibles argument?
Oh, I do. I do think that, and maybe this is also a way in which he is similar to Tim Tebow, in that I think Lin has an effect on the players around him. And it's not just the fact that he passes the ball well and he gets them nice shots and helps them, score points and get easy baskets. It is, you know, his enthusiasm. It is the way that he seems to inject a jolt of energy into the team. So I do think there are intangibles that are at play here as well.
Well, Phil Taylor, I want to thank you for your injection of energy and insight. Phil Taylor, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Jay, Caspian Kang, same thing. We'll be looking out for the new novel. Jay's an editor at Grantland. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. And I do want to point out and congratulate ourselves, this was to be a no-pun zone, and I think we did get through this without too many Jeremy Lin puns. Some have been good, most not. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Mike Pesca, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.